Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In honor of the holidays and Thanksgiving in particular, we wanted to share this memory from Layuna Rapp about her family's turkey farm in Greenbrier County, West Virginia. Back in the 1940s, it was Layuna's job to follow the turkeys like a secret agent and discover where the birds hid their nests.
They always wanted to go a long ways from home. They wanted to go clear down and cross 219 down over the hill in some woods and lay those eggs. And I'd have to go sit there all day like this, waiting for her to lay her eggs so she'd go back home.
Today, turkey raising is a bit different, though.
Yeah. Oh, I know. No one would ever turn a turkey loose now.
Today, we're taking a look at the myths and the truths of the wild turkey. No, not the straight Kentucky bourbon. The animal. Although, you might find some of the stiff 101-proof liquor on some Thanksgiving tables. But anyway, here's another interesting turkey story. In the early 1900s, before trucks transported farm animals, turkeys often had to be herded by foot to the train station. Sometimes this meant they'd travel for a full day to reach the nearest train, where they were then taken to the market. But often the turkeys' feet would get all cut up from walking so long on the road. So sometimes the farmers made special turkey booties. At least that's according to B.J. Goodmanson of Marlinton, West Virginia. She wrote us a message about the turkey drives that the old-timers used to talk about. She says they had the turkeys walk through tar and then straw, and, well, you get the idea, and that protected their feet for walking long distances on the roadways. So turkeys with tar shoes marching overnight across the mountain. Hey, you know what? I'd love to see a photo of that. So what's your favorite turkey memory? Or do you prefer just to eat them? But hey, and we won't judge you either way for that. Join the conversation on Twitter and let us know how you remember Thanksgivings of the past, and whether turkey hunting or turkey farming are a part of your family's story. Our Twitter handle is @InAppalachia. I'm @JessicaYLilly.
Hi, I'm Jane Wright, Director of Grants and Underwriting at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Do you love Inside Appalachia? Do you have a message about your business or organization that you'd like to reach the show's thousands of listeners on 11 stations across the region? Then I'd love to help you make that happen. You can learn more about becoming an underwriter on Inside Appalachia by calling me at 304-556-4930 or by dropping me a line at jwright@wvpublic.org. Thanks.
The holidays has us thinking about turkeys today on our show, and you may have heard a legend that says Benjamin Franklin wanted the national bird to be the turkey rather than the bald eagle. While that's not true, it is true that Franklin called the bald eagle a bird of bad moral character, and he admired the wild turkey for being, as he wrote to his daughter, a much more respectable bird. Have you ever heard that turkeys can't fly? I had. And boy, was it confusing to see a turkey gliding through the air. I thought I'd seen an anomaly of a bird, I tell you. And it's true that domestic turkeys are too heavy to fly, but wild turkeys can fly up to 55 miles an hour. Allison Kwans, producer for the podcast With Good Reason, found that even pilots have an appreciation for turkey flight.
If you've ever stopped to watch a hawk wheel and turn through the sky, you can imagine that pilots might find inspiration in birds. Captain Eric Walden is a fourth-generation pilot, and there's one bird that he's taken note of.
It's very difficult to find them, especially when you're looking for them. You can stalk around in the woods and fields all day long and never find a single one.
Walden is talking, of course, about wild turkeys.
The flying part is always stunning, because you think there's no way these animals are going to fly away, and the whole flock will take flight in the middle of a dense forest and disappear.
A wild turkey can weigh over 20 pounds. That's about as heavy as a car tire.
You'd imagine the legs that can move something like that at high speed and with a high level of agility. They don't just run in a straight line, but they jink and turn and leap over obstacles and move very fast while they're doing it. The size of the legs, if you ever been to a county fair or something like that, you have turkey legs for sale, and the thing looks like it came off a dinosaur. You know, it's 18 inches long and 6 inches around and weighs, 5 pounds. So those are the legs.
And those big chunky legs make sense because turkeys spend most of their lives on the ground. But sometimes they have to fly in order to live.
Flying is a tool that they use to escape and move short distances.
It's that moment of transition from ground to air that Walden finds particularly remarkable. And I'm going to let him take it from here. So close your eyes, put yourself in the middle of a field or forest, and imagine a car tire sprouting wings.
These big fat wings come out of the side of the body and just start pummeling the ground. Grass and leaves and branches flying all over the place, and they're all doing it simultaneously. And then somebody trips and has to get up. They're in this dash to reach flight velocity, but the first several beats of the wings, they're grasping at the air. So it looks like they're barely gonna make it. And as a pilot, I can relate to that. The first few moments after liftoff, you're the most exposed. You're close to the ground, you're at low speed, you have very few options. So if the turkey at this point comes across an obstacle it can't clear, there's gonna be a crash. But the legs tuck into the body and all of a sudden he's transformed into an aerial ninja. They can fly through a tight forest on a steep hill in between trees, either turning sideways, knife edge, or actually tucking their wings together and shooting in between two trees like a feathered missile. And on the other side, unfurling those big fat wings to execute a 90-degree turn, probably pulling as many G's as an F-22 fighter pilot in an aggressive maneuver. Using those legs so they can bounce off of trees, bounce off of the ground, do like a half flight, half running dance, I suppose. But it's not really a dance because it looks ridiculous. The transition from flight to ground is as unceremonious. They don't come in and flutter and alight softly upon the ground. They basically pick a spot, they crash to the ground, sliding through the grass and the leaves. But they hop right back up. They're tough birds. And they pop those periscope necks up and take a look around. And if everything looks good to go, then they just go back to being a ground-based bird.
For With Good Reason, I'm Allison Quance.
The podcast With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, and we're getting some help from them on our holiday-inspired show today. Thanksgiving is a time when many families go home. And for me, that always meant just a few miles away, about an hour's drive. I never understood the national reports that talked about this airport congestion and flight delays since Granny's house was just a trip over the mountain. It's also a holiday, often referred to as Turkey Day, since it's traditionally the main course of the meal, you know. Next, we're going to hear from a man who spent 2 years raising wild turkeys, and they all thought that he was their mother. Here's Joe Hutto telling his experience to With Good Reason's host, Sarah McConnell.
Joe, you wrote and illustrated the incredible book, Illumination in the Flatwoods, which was later turned into My Life as a Turkey. It's about the 2 years you spent as a turkey mother. How'd you get to be a turkey mother?
Well, I got the eggs. Turkey hens, when they're sitting on their nest, they actually talk to their eggs. And so I actually did that. I would try to talk to the eggs and turkey. I understood a little wild turkey vocabulary. And so I'd make little turkey-like sounds. And it was amazing. When they hatched, they absolutely knew who I was.
Can you give me a little bit of turkey sound?
No.
I mean, you can't. You can't.
No, I'm not going on radio and television and make turkey noises.
Yeah.
You know, the truth is that I got very good at that.
Yeah.
But it's almost like learning a foreign language. And I haven't spoken wild turkey, as silly as that sounds, in quite a few years. And so I've almost lost the capacity to do it.
You didn't just get handed eggs. You'd wanted them for a long time, right?
That's right. I just had this opportunity. Somebody brought me two clutches of these wild turkey eggs that the nests had been destroyed by tractors mowing through the woods. And I said, okay, I'm going to do this. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Young people who have seen that movie are so inspired by your experience and ask you, how did you do it? What do you say to them?
I get asked this question a lot. You know, how do I do what you do? And it's very difficult. When I was in college, you couldn't study ethology. That's what I do. I'm an ethologist. And what that is a person who studies animal behavior in a natural setting. I don't use cages or any type of enclosure. And so my objective is to observe animal behavior and intelligence and consciousness in its most natural form. And up until very recently, that was not an area of academics that a person could go into. And now that's changing in biology. But when I was in college, if you wanted to study animal behavior, you went into behavioral psychology and studied rudimentary Pavlovian concepts having to do with stimulus and response and habituation. And it really didn't lend much insight into true animal behavior and consciousness.
Did you experience joy and the sort of sense of love and protection when these little turkeys hatched?
Absolutely. It's like being around any newborn animal. You know, I think biologically we're predisposed to have a parental response to a young animal. And it's precisely that response that I think lends the most insight to an observer, that you actually fall in love with these little creatures like a parent. And as a result, your interest becomes almost obsessive. And if you've observed a new mother with a child, you notice that she almost can't take her eyes off that creature. And that's the way it is with a young animal that you've imprinted. You have this incredible fascination and empathy. And every little subtle nuance is suddenly very fascinating.
From watching My Life as a Turkey, it seemed that your turkeys were so smart, and yet all my life people have said turkeys are stupid.
Well, that's a sad thing. And, you know, they've bred the domestic turkey to almost pathetic, grotesque creatures. And wild turkeys are very, very different, and they are incredibly intelligent and very sensitive, and they're social creatures, and they have this ability to relate and to learn. You know, I use the word consciousness a lot in my research because that's essentially what I study is not just animal intelligence, but their consciousness, you know, their experience of the world and their experience of you and their ability to learn how the universe works around them.
You have said that you think it is selfish and arrogant for the human species to think that we alone possess that kind of consciousness and that you, in fact, saw this in your turkeys.
We have no privileged access to reality. Consciousness is almost biologically mandated. You know, you have to have this conscious will to survive, and that's this razor's edge. Consciousness is being awake on the planet, just being awake. And wild creatures, out of absolute necessity, have to be totally awake, totally alert. They have to be ready. They have to be actually willing to think about things. All creatures, out of absolute necessity, have to experience some level of consciousness just to maintain their existence.
You've even said that the wild turkeys you lived with had problem-solving intelligence. How so?
Well, they were far more intelligent than me, in a sense.
Yeah.
They understood, almost without exception, every plant and every animal. And the specificity of that knowledge was stunning. They knew every insect. They knew if it was edible. They knew if it was dangerous. And so not only did they know these plants and these animals, but in many cases, they had specific vocalizations to describe these. And so I would hear a certain vocalization from a turkey or several turkeys, and I would know without question, not only had they found a snake, but I would know exactly what species of snake they had found. And so I would walk right past a large diamondback rattlesnake coiled in some blackberries, and the turkeys would immediately notify me that I had done something really stupid.
Is it true that wild turkeys can't be bred in captivity?
It is. Wild turkeys were almost hunted into extinction in the turn of the last century and during the Depression, you know, where there were subsistence hunters, and then there were a lot of desperate people, and they almost disappeared from the landscape.
What brought them back?
Law enforcement brought them back. States realized, federal government realized that these animals were going to have to be regulated. And so we had hunting seasons, and, you know, and that's true with many species. You know, white-tailed deer were almost hunted into extinction. For the most part, wild turkeys are very abundant, but it's principally because of wildlife management and that consciousness that it has to be regulated.
So how did you mother your turkeys and raise them in the wild?
My main concern was keeping them alive at night. First light in the morning, they would immediately fly down to me, and I would take them out of the cage as the sun was coming up or as it was getting light, and we would stay out all day. And then we would come in right before dark, and we would enter the cage. They would follow me in. They would fly up on their little roosting limbs, and after it got completely dark, I would literally have to sneak out of the cage so that they wouldn't fly down to the ground and try to follow me.
I remember nights like that as a mother.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. You just do what you have to do.
Right. And, of course, as with any parent, you experienced as the mother of these turkeys just how distinctive their personalities were from the get-go. Let me play this excerpt from your film where you talk about two of your turkeys that you were very fond of, one named Turkey Boy and the other one Sweet Pea.
I now know each of the birds by their character and personality as much as by their appearance. Turkey Boy is still up to his old tricks. He's always pushing his brothers and sisters around, but no one seems to mind too much. Sweet Pea still has this need for closeness. She stares motionless at me for what seems like a very long time, and it's obviously a conscious behavior. It's as though she's trying to absorb something. Being the object of such intense scrutiny by such a little thing is a very strange sensation. Turkey Boy and I we couldn't have been closer, and we couldn't have had a closer relationship.
I can't remember. Did you let him be dominant?
I did. I didn't have the right body language because I'm not really a turkey, and I don't really speak wild turkey vocabulary.
Yeah.
Joe Hadeau is a naturalist, author, and Emmy Award-winning filmmaker. His most recent book is The Light in High Places. Still to come, we'll hear more about the type of turkey that Americans usually eat. And because Thanksgiving week is also a time when many Appalachian families go hunting, we'll travel to a West Virginia cook-off that celebrates Hunter's Stew. That and more coming up in the second half of the show. But first, it's time for What's in a Name, where we explore the history and folklore behind Appalachian places. Today, we're going to play a game to find out what's in a name. We have a guest who is going to guess this week's What's in a Name quest. Chris Oxley works in our production department at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. He's in our Charleston studio. Chris, so, hey, have you ever driven by a town and wondered how the heck did they come up with that name?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, any that kind of stick out?
Greasy Ridge Road sticks out to me because I don't know the difference between your greasy ridges and your non-stick ridges.
I guess the ones that that you can actually climb, perhaps. I don't know. Okay. All right, Chris. It's Thanksgiving week, so we're going to a dessert-themed town. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right, there's your hint. So you had it. Are you sure you're ready?
I'm always ready.
Okay, all right. So do you know the town in Appalachia that got its name from one man's obsession with a particular dessert? Is it pie, West Virginia, fudge, North Carolina, or strudel, Pennsylvania? All of them sound delicious, right? But which one?
I'm going to go with strudel, Pennsylvania.
Strudel, Pennsylvania. Strudels are delicious.
Yeah, I believe there was an influx of immigrants from, you know, of Germans, of Austrians, of Switzerlandians, and all kinds of Central European places. And they just brought their love of flaky pastries to Pennsylvania, and this guy was really into it, blown away, and says, we got to name this town by this wonderful, wonderful pastry.
Indeed, indeed. Delicious, flaky pastries, indeed. Chris Oxley going with the evidence-based answer with strudel, Pennsylvania. He's got his own evidence and story to go with it. Is he right? We'll find out in just a minute, right after the break.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Going across the mountain.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly, back with this week's What's in a Name quest. So which town in Appalachia got its name because of one man's obsession with his favorite dessert? So Chris, you guessed strudel, Pennsylvania. And you were wrong. Yeah, delicious indeed, but not quite what we were looking for. The answer is actually Pye, West Virginia. It's the town located between Horse Run
Pie.
Mountain and Granch Branch.
So Pie. They were obsessed with 3.14157876333247376.
Ah, the exact number. That's quite impressive there, Chris Oxley.
Thanks. I'm a human calculator.
We spoke with Pam Warden, the director of the Mingo County Public Library System, to learn more. Here's what she said.
From what I know, they got their name by a man called Leander Blankenship. He was a resident at Pye, and he gave the community that name because they said he liked pies no matter what kind they were.
So that's how Pye, West Virginia, earned its name. Chris, thanks for playing our first ever What's in a Name game with us this week.
Great. It was fun, educational, and fascinating.
And thanks for playing along. Maybe we'll have to have you back on because it was a lot of fun.
Yes, anytime.
Would you like to play the What's in a Name game with us next week? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia or call us at 304-556-4936 and see if you can guess correctly. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. All right, here's some turkey trivia for you. Did you know the turkeys we buy at the grocery store are all of a white feather kind? It's strange because, you know, if you Google turkey, what comes up are pictures of those dark feathered turkeys that we all drew pictures of in grade school, you know? So how did we come to eat only white turkeys? With good reasons, Lilia Fukin traveled to a free-range turkey farm where she learned how the so-called bronze turkey went out of fashion decades ago.
Here, in the Blue Ridge Mountains of Central Virginia, I've come to visit an organic turkey farmer.
A female turkey goes, oh, 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 and a male turkey goes, bow, 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 bow. It's only the male turkeys that gobble, not the female turkeys.
This is Paul Kelly, the British owner of this 100-acre farm that's now the first North American branch of the Kelly Bronze Company. And Judd Culver is the local farmer here.
Hey, gobble, 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 hey.
These guys love turkeys. And this farm is unique because they're raising free-range bronze turkeys. Bronze turkeys are the dark-feathered birds we usually associate with turkey. And even though these were brought here from Britain, they're actually native to the Americas.
Every turkey in the world originally was bronze in feather. It came from Mexico. It's the old, slow-growing bronze breed.
The Kelly Bronze motto is bred to be wild. So these turkeys live in the great outdoors. They roost in trees at night, and they can fly.
They normally like to run before they fly, because they are kind of big and bulky, right? So if a predator comes, they will take off running. And then if they have to, then they'll fly.
So why is a British guy bringing the bronze turkey back to the U.S.? Paul explains that it's because the bronze turkey has pretty much disappeared from the market. And this started back in the 1950s. As a result of factory farming, people were getting more and more removed from their food sources. And they started to get really turned off by these little pin feathers that were left in the turkey's skin after plucking.
The whole reason the bronze turkey disappeared back in the 1950s was because of the little black feather stub in the skin.
And grocery stores wanted a cleaner look for their customers.
That bronze feather seemed to be unsightly, and the up-and-coming supermarkets wanted a really nice pearly white skin for the plastic bags. Frozen was fashionable. And the bronze turkey literally went out of fashion all in the space of 5 or 6 years, purely for aesthetics.
It turns out the white turkeys people have been buying in grocery stores for the past 60 years have the very same pin feathers. They're just harder to see.
The white turkey's got exactly the same amount of feather quills, but of course it's a white pigment. You don't see it.
Do we end up eating those?
You do.
We do.
But when you're eating a white turkey, you're eating them anyway. It's good protein. Look at it that way. We call it designer stubble. That's what we call it.
In 1971, Paul's father was disillusioned with the industrial poultry business, and the bronze turkeys were practically becoming extinct. So it was a radical move when Paul's parents started raising bronze turkeys. Like heirloom vegetables and flowers, these turkeys are from a pretty old, sturdy genetic stock. But that's not the only thing that's different about this Kelly Bronze turkey farm. They hand process each turkey by dry plucking them and then aging the birds before Thanksgiving customers come to pick them up.
In England, we call it New York dressed. We're dry plucking them by hand and hanging them, as you would a pheasant. Turkey's a game bird and it should be hung, before preparing it for the oven. It's nothing new. What we're doing actually is very, very old. It's nothing new at all. It's just tradition to the extreme.
Judd says that another important factor is timing. They let the turkeys reach sexual maturity before harvesting, rather than harvesting them at a certain weight.
We grow these guys sexual maturity. They have tons of fat. I mean, sexual maturity, like any animal, is when you start to get fat, right? So, I mean, it's part of the profile.
Because our birds are so mature, there's a lot of fat marbling running through the meat, and fat conducts the heat through the muscle tissue quicker. So it will cook in twice the time.
When it comes to cooking the turkey, Paul has one word of advice.
Please don't brine it. Just plain roast it, 2 to 2.5 hours, and you'll have an amazing Thanksgiving feast.
For more information on the Bred to be Wild Kelly Bronze Turkey Farm in Greenwood, Virginia, go to kellyturkeys.co.uk. For With Good Reason, I'm Lilia Fukin. You make everything.
And speaking of cooking wild turkeys, have you ever tasted wild rattlesnake or venison stew? That's coming up later on our show here on Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back. Today we're finding out more about the food that's usually on our Thanksgiving table. We're talking turkey. While we're on the topic of food, we wanted to hear from a couple of turkey farmers down in southwestern Virginia. They also sell their meats and vegetables at the Abington Farmers Market. And back in 2015, Roxy Todd met Richard Moyer and his daughter, Christina, who at the time was 16 years old. They were selling their locally grown food to customers.
The Abington Farmers Market was buzzing around 9 a.m., I stopped by one booth for breakfast, a homemade quiche with bacon and fresh cheese. That was delicious. I grabbed some coffee and I wandered the outdoor farmers market to see what people were selling. It was fall, and so the market was bursting with vegetables. I stopped by to chat with one of the farmers named Richard Moyer.
You can see over there customers are picking through our tomatoes. We do heirloom tomatoes and heirloom beans. There's a bean over there called rattlesnake, which is a mottled bean.
An heirloom food is a traditional variety that comes from a seed that's been passed down for years and years. Many of the heirlooms Richard was selling have been grown in Virginia for generations. He was also selling ground beef, steaks, roasts, and soup beans from a handheld cooler.
And we've had people come and buy some of this meat in this cooler, and they'll come back and say, I want that, some more of that beef. It tastes like the beef I grew up with.
Richard says his family rarely buys food from the store. One of his sons really likes mustard, and sometimes the only thing they go to the grocery store for is mustard.
We have our own eggs, our own meats, our own vegetables, fruits, mushrooms.
Families with babies were in the crowd, surrounding us as we spoke. The market started to fill with more customers. Richard knew a lot of the customers by name.
I think that gives comfort to some people that they want to connect. People want to connect with their food. They want to connect with the people that grew their food. And when we grow this way and sell this way at a market like this, it allows people to do that and have face-to-face interaction.
While he was talking, Richard's 16-year-old daughter, Christina, was helping bag green beans and sell to customers. Like her dad, Christina says she likes the foods they sell, with special names that are traditional to Appalachia.
I like heirloom foods just because they've been around a long time. People have grown for a long time, and especially if they're from this area, if there's something that doesn't do well around here, you know, it wouldn't be around.
Why do you think some people like to grow GMO or buy GMO?
Well, growing GMO, one of the big things is weeds. If you have a small corn patch, you can keep up with the weeds by hoeing. But if you've got 10 acres of corn, you can cultivate when it's young, but there's not a really good way, unless you have a lot of labor and go out and hoe, there's not a really good effective way to control weeds. So I think a lot of people like heirloom corns better, but I think part of the reason that people grow GMO is just the weed problem. If it wasn't for that, I don't think many people would grow it.
Christina loves farming. At home, her chores include milking Buttercup, their cow, and taking care of the chickens, turkeys, ducks, and geese. She also helps work in the family garden and sell at the Saturday farmers market.
My daughter Christina, I joke with that she's my farm manager. And what I mean by that is she observes. She observes here at the market. She walks around at the market and sees what's in season, who's growing what. And she notices holes in production. Like if there's no lettuce in a certain part of the year, or there's not enough beans or other crops, she says, we could grow that then. And so at home, on our farm, the animals we have, the crops that we grow, she remembers year to year what we've grown, what does well in certain parts of the year. When we're planning for the next year, Christina says we didn't have enough of that, or we had too much of that. Or she has a great memory of what works well here and how to do more of the same. So we rely on her, and we're talking with her about, over the long term, this being her business of growing and selling here at the market.
But part of that future, for Christina and for Richard, depends on to what extent their neighbors decide to grow GMO crops. See, their family's income isn't made entirely by selling at this farmer's market. A lot of what they earn on their farm is made by selling seeds to the Southern Exposure seed catalog.
We grow heirloom corns, corn seed, and we test our corn. We pay $200 per corn crop to have it tested for the absence of detectable GMO contamination. So if I have a neighbor that grows a solid corn and pollen from his corn blows over and contaminates my corn, I can lose my entire contract, thousands of dollars of corn that I can no longer sell because my neighbor grows a corn that's a GMO corn and contaminates my corn crop. So the burden falls on me to test all my crops to show that they're GMO free at the limit of detection.
But this economic threat to Richard's farming isn't his main concern.
For me as a grower, as a farmer, I think there's the potential of losing local foods, losing the ways of growing the traditionally that we've done. So I see more as just a loss of the foods that have sustained us.
Heirloom farmers like Richard and Christina say GMOs are different, very different from the types of plants they grow on their farm. Beyond their concerns that farming could change because of GMOs, they believe heirloom seeds have history, a story, and that history is part of what they identify with as growers here in Appalachia. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Abington, Virginia.
So, as we just heard, some farmers who grow heirloom seeds have some concerns about genetically modified foods in Appalachia. But just how common are GMOs in the foods that we eat, in particular the foods that we often eat during Thanksgiving? And while it might not be such a good idea to bug your Thanksgiving host about GMOs while you're eating, here's some food for thought for the next time you're at the grocery store. A couple of years ago, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant and Kara Halsoppel got together during Thanksgiving to cook and to talk about the complicated GMO issue.
Careful, it's going to be hot. It smells so good in here. She's got bread baking in the oven, and now she's just getting going on the prep for her Thanksgiving meal. Hey, Julie.
Hey, Kara. Thanks so much for stopping by.
Well, thanks for having us. Okay, so what do you have going here?
Well, as with any good meal, I'm starting by chopping an onion. I stopped by the farm market to shop, and they were showing this film, GMO OMG. You've probably heard of it. It's about genetically modified organisms in our food. So I decided to talk with a few people. I met Kathleen Chaquin and Tony Gosmer. They're teachers at an inner city school. Here's what they had to say.
We're real concerned about food for a lot of reasons, for ourselves and our students. We work in inner city, and a lot of these kids they're getting
zero nutrition. They're suffering from nutritional deficiencies, but we're trying to raise scores, and they're eating GMO, corn and soy, every other day, and that's what they're eating.
And you feel like that affects their ability to learn?
Oh, yes. Nobody knows what these side effects are going to be. It's long term.
Okay, so there are many people with concerns about GMOs. Since we're here for Thanksgiving, what's GMO on our holiday plate?
Okay, we've got some winter squash here, some delicata, some acorn squash. Those are not GMO. But some of the summer squash, the crookneck, the straight neck, yellow squashes, and zucchinis, some of those are bioengineered, and it makes them resistant to common squash viruses.
What about my favorite Thanksgiving side, the mashed potatoes? What about potatoes?
Well, there aren't GMO potatoes on the market yet. The Food and Drug Administration did approve a GMO potato. It's supposed to be less likely to bruise. And those are supposed to be on the market in 2017. And it's the same thing with GMO apples.
Yeah, you have some apples here on the countertop, and they, I guess, are going to be in a pie later today. What about GMO apples?
Yeah, so the GMO apples that are supposedly coming out are engineered so they don't brown after you cut them.
So how does that work?
The way they say they do it is they modify them to remove the enzyme that turns an apple brown after it's been exposed to oxygen in the air.
But how do we know which apples are GMO in the store?
Well, same thing. None of them are GMO yet. The ones that are going to be GMO come 2017 are under the brand name Arctic Apples, and they're making them in the Granny Smith and Golden Delicious varieties.
Okay, you've got your cutting board out here, and oh, you're cutting corn right off the cob. What are we making with that?
Well, this is going to be a corn soup to start off the meal. Now, corn, this is a big player in the GMO world. 90% of corn grown in the U.S. is what's called Roundup Ready.
That's when they modify it to make it resistant to the herbicide Roundup.
Exactly. And more specifically than Roundup is glyphosate. That's the chemical that's in Roundup and is now found in other name brands as well. And farmers can spray this herbicide all over the fields. The idea is that it kills the weeds, but the crops survive.
So this corn, the sweet corn that you're cutting right now, is it GMO?
It's hard to tell. Most sweet corn that you buy is actually not GMO. It's the field corn that's the real GMO player. That's what's fed to animals. It's mixed in with GMO soybeans and other grains. It also winds up in our processed food. So anything with corn syrup or soy protein isolate, things like that, that's GMO.
We're having Thanksgiving here in the U.S., but haven't European countries been banning GMOs?
Yeah, many have. I spoke with Mark Linus about this. He used to be an anti-GMO activist in England. He then very publicly came out and said he supports genetically engineered foods. He's now political director for the Cornell Alliance for Science. That's at Cornell University. And he does not like this move in Europe toward banning GMOs.
And there are certain countries which are just against the use of the technology, really per se. Germany is one of them, France is another, Italy is another. So some of the big countries in Central Europe really don't allow an informed scientific debate on the GMO issue at all.
And Linus says that's bad for places that could really use GMOs, places like in sub-Saharan Africa. He says the European bans scare them off of genetically engineered crops, but he says GMO foods could really help to feed people.
Remember, there's a big difference between the situation in somewhere like Uganda and somewhere like France. In France, people have sufficient food, and they can make a choice to buy organic, and they can make a choice to buy non-GMO, and it doesn't make any difference to their food security. That's not really the case in East Africa, where there's several emerging new diseases which really only have solutions using GM technology.
So Linus has changed his tune on GMOs, but there are lots of other people who are still concerned.
Yes. So to hear more about that, I got in touch with the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. Franklin Egan is PASA's director of education. He says for the past 20 years, GMOs haven't really been used to feed people.
Almost all the attention has been on commodity crops, on corn and soybeans and other row crops, and not on improving food crops, you know, vegetables and fruits that actually provide sustenance to people.
Most of those commodity crops in the U.S. use that Roundup Ready system.
Well, thanks, Julie.
It's so fun to have you here, Kara.
It's great to be here. And now let's just set this GMO stuff to the side for a moment and enjoy everything that you've made for us. Can you pass the bread, please?
That was the Allegheny Front's Kara Hulsoppel and Julie Grant. The Allegheny Front reports on the environment from Pittsburgh. More at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we've learned that turkeys really can fly and how the brown turkey went out of fashion. For our final story, we'll dip into the Inside Appalachia archives for a classic appetite, Appalachia.
Cornbread and butter beans and you across the table. Beans
appetite Appalachia is an occasional segment here on the show, which features restaurants and recipes with Appalachian roots. This week, we're traveling to a festival in Webster Springs, West Virginia, where chefs compete to win the best hunter stew, which in this area is known as burgoo. Back in 2014, Roxy Todd went to the cook-off where she tasted burgoos made with snapping turtle, rattlesnake, elk, and bear.
On a cold, dreary October day, a crowd of 600 people gather in the little town of Webster Springs. 20 cooks and 20 burgoos.
This is the greatest stew on earth today.
One of the local volunteers, Kevin Legg, is about to announce the greatest stew on earth.
There's some fine stew here today.
Helping judge the best of these burgoos is Tim Urbanek, chef and owner of Cafe Cimino.
You gotta love burgoo. I really did like the rattlesnake and the snapper turtle. I think it's really underused ingredients in so much of our cooking. But it's such a heritage food. The couple of people that did that here really did a fabulous job on it. I always loved wild game. There was a lot of bear here, elk, of course, venison. You know, that's pretty much a staple in these hills. For the most part, it's a pretty hard thing to judge.
The crowd gets to choose a people's choice burgoo, too. Like Chef Urbanek, Shane Grove says he likes the one with rattlesnake.
I like the rattlesnake one. That was unique, although I didn't know which meat was rattlesnake, but it was good. Very strong. I think it had bear in it as well with rattlesnake, maybe a rabbit in there. That was my favorite so far.
Angie Cowger and Alyssa Clayton are about to vote for their favorites, too.
I like the spicier one, but I like the tomato-y spice, like
taste. It was a variance of spices. It was like the...
One tasted like kind of like Skyline chili, like it had like nutmeg and some cinnamon and some different spices that you wouldn't expect to find in a stew. So,
and then there was one that had like enchilada seasoning.
Yep.
And it was really good. I liked it. Mine had it was just like very, very meaty. It was very meaty. And she said I think it had caribou in it and elk or something. It was really good though.
I head over to talk with Johnny McCourt about his burgoo, which has a lot of people talking.
It's just a basic turtle stew, you know, some vegetables. We got some squirrel meat in there and some wild turkey breast.
And snapping turtle, right?
Snapping turtle, yes, snapping turtle. We didn't follow a recipe to make it. This is the first time we've ever did it. It probably cooked altogether about 7 hours. It takes a long time to cook the turtle tender. and cook it till it's falling off the bone, then take it off there and kind of shred it.
Johnny McCourt and his cousin don't win the Burgoo Cook-Off this year, but they say they'll try again next year, and they're sticking with local wild game ingredients. And that approach to cooking Burgoo is authentic, and there's something to admire about that. But making a Burgoo that makes people return for seconds, that is an art. Each cook is competing against 19 other people, and getting it right can take days of work. It can also take years to master the art of the perfect Burgoo, says Carolyn Blakemore of Fairmont. She's been competing at this festival for years, and many people here call her Mrs. Burgoo.
Every time you make it, it's a little different. Now, I like mine thick, and I have three different meats. I have beef and veal and pork and with spicy seasonings, and I call it Southwest Burgoo from West Virginia.
Do you have any secrets?
I just make it to my taste and hope that the judges enjoy it. And I like to do cooking and baking contests. I travel when I can and enter different contests, and sometimes I win.
88-year-old Carolyn has been teaching her granddaughter, Gabrielle Anderson, to carry on the tradition. Gabrielle is competing in this year's Burgoo Cook-Off. They travel together to cooking competitions throughout West Virginia.
I think one of the best part about, you know, the Webster Springs competition is the fact that it really draws everybody from not only the state, but the surrounding states, PA, Kentucky, Ohio. The last 3 years, I've known pie bakers that have come from PA and Ohio just for the actual apple pie part of the competition.
20 apple pies. The steam is rolling off them in the chilly air. Carolyn Blakemore's pie has these little yellow caramelized flecks of local golden delicious apples from Marion County sprinkled on top of her pie. It's a beautiful sight.
My name is Betsy Morris, and I'm a judge today for the pie contest. And these are all apple pies, and they have to be made from scratch crust. And the apples have to be fresh. They can be frozen, but they have to be not a canned, not a store-bought. And so they're very good. They're scrumptious, and the ones that are warm, oh, my, on this cold day, they taste wonderful. People brought them just fresh out of the oven. They are delicious. I just need ice cream.
So your job is to taste 20 different apple pies, basically?
Basically, that's what I get to do today. How wonderful for me. And one of these has Coca-Cola in it. I've never tasted that before, but it's very good. Two has Parmesan cheese in the crust, and I had never eaten that before.
Once judged, the pies are all auctioned off to raise money for the town of Webster Springs, which organizes this event.
Stew number two was Carolyn Blakemore from Fairmont.
By mid-afternoon, Carolyn, a.k.a. Mrs. Burgoo, ends up winning third prize for her Burgoo, and third prize as well for her apple pie. The Burgoo grand prize this year goes to Tammy Moffitt, who had a friend bring her back elk and buffalo from a hunting trip out west. Reporting from Webster Springs, the Burgoo capital of West Virginia, I'm Roxy Todd.
That story originally aired in 2014. The Burgoo Cook-Off is held every October in Webster Springs, West Virginia.
I'm going across the mountain. If I have to crawl, I'll give old Jessamine a little my rifle ball. Way before it's good day, if nothing happens to me, oh, I'll be way down yonder in old Tennessee.
Year after year, Appalachians have ventured over mountains to make it back home for the holidays. And rather than just see the ridges and valleys as unpassable, yeah, these roads can be treacherous, but it's an afterthought. To me, it's just the way home. It's more than a holiday like Thanksgiving that brings us together. It's satisfying our need or want to belong. Trying to find a place where I'm welcome. Coming together seems more important today than in many past years. We are stronger together when we reach across the lines to try and understand each other. Sometimes that means crossing political party lines, and sometimes it just means crossing the dinner table. Folks around my Thanksgiving dinner table have changed. It's not the same as it used to be, and that's a little sad, a little scary, and leaves me a little nostalgic. But I'm not just going to abandon my people because we disagree or it's hard for us to understand each other. I'll stick with my tribe and venture across the mountain, once again, to make it back home. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities and the Allegheny Front. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps and Anna and Elizabeth. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our Appetite Appalachia theme music is by the Carolina Sunshine Trio. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Jesse Wright. Our audio mixer is Xander Alloy. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, wvpublic.org, or wherever you get your podcast. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
If I had a boat, I'd go out on the ocean. And if I had a pony, I'd ride him on my boat. And we could all together go out on the ocean. Me upon my pony on my boat. And if I were Roy Rogers, I'd sure enough be single. I couldn't bring myself to marry an old Dale. Well, it would just be me.